get started. I want to
apologize for last week. I felt like I was kind of walking through mud last week. I don't know. I feel like learned. So I hope this week goes somewhat better. The intention is to finish Reason and do the transition to Spirit, but not to actually do Antigone. We'll do Antigone in Rome next week. So, but I want to really work on the transition, I hope, for the whole second half. So we ended last week where we were talking about that form of prudential reasoning that is no longer troubled by the opposition between world and agent. That the form of rationality appropriate here is a sophisticated form of means-ends rationality, the idea of reason as simply what helps me realize my life plan, and the suggestion that Hegel makes is that using such a reason could not qualify as providing good reasons unless it fit into a context of meaning larger than that of the individual. That is, Hegel thinks I have to think of myself as acting in a social context in which my reasons are or intrinsically have the aspect of being for another. And that the for another aspect of an action has a role in it itself. And I asked what way in which prudential reasoning might or might not be adequate to this task, since, and here's the issue, prudential reasoning simply takes for granted the super-individual context. But in so doing, does it run into difficulty? And the way Hegel presents it is as a duality between what he calls doing and being. Right? And doing and being here is for itself and for another. That's what he's thinking. Well, what is the problem between action? So the duality of doing and being is also he says that there must be action and work, where the work now is the work accomplished by the action. So what's the problem? And he says at the beginning that the doing of an action is to be understood as my action, as seen from my point of view, as defined by my intention or my intentions, in the light of my general purposes, that is, in terms of my life plan. Hence the idea of a generalized form of prudential reasoning. The doing of an action is an action as seen from the inside, that is, the agent's perspective on the action. The being of an action, conversely, is the meaning of what is done. So you can think of this as the gap, which we're going to be interrogating a lot of, the gap between intention and result. I've just been talking to a class about Eichmann in Jerusalem, and that's also what that work is about. The whole purpose of Eichmann in Jerusalem is a critique of intentionalism. That's all it's really about. Okay, I won't go through that. Another class, another time. It is the actual work that results, and the implications of that act, whether or not I have seen them or intended them. So what is done is the actual result, whether intended or not. So he might say the being of an action is an outside or third person perspective on that same action. That you can see things from your point of view or from the result as seen from the outside. Now the reason for this duality, which I'm going to spend a lot of time on over the next 4 or 5 weeks, and this is absolutely central to all of Hegel's thinking and why I want to come to, is that actions, not just sometimes, but routinely, have unintended consequences. And it's the fact that this is routine that is so important for Hegel. What I have control over is what might be called doing. What I cannot control is the meaning of the doing. And just to remind you that the whole point, I might argue, of Descartes' philosophy is to utterly cut off, bifurcate absolutely the gap between what I can control and what I cannot control. And roughly and readily, Descartes calls what I can control the subject and calls what I cannot control the world. That's the basis of his distinction between res cogitans and res extensio, the two types of substances. So he thinks that the notion of control, which is why when he writes in The Passions of the Soul, what you end up with is a type of stoical consideration of the will. That you should never promise what you can, you know, do not promise anything beyond what you can absolutely control, and nothing is binding for Descartes except what you have under your immediate control of your will. And this duality is, I want to further say, built into the liberal concept of the person. That the liberal concept of a person defines responsibility, and this is written into the law. This is not just a queer philosophical notion. Namely, an agent is responsible for just and only what they intend, and they are not morally responsible for unintended consequences. And that, just to, you know, for those of us who watch Law and Order all the time, right, that's the distinction between murder and manslaughter, to give an example, right? So that liberal anthropology of the person is built into the very structure of law. And now you can see why I was talking about Eichmann in Jerusalem, because Eichmann's intentions were not exactly to kill 6 million people. That wasn't what he was thinking about. Right? That wasn't. It's not that he wasn't doing that, but wasn't the overriding intention. It's not as if you want to call the Holocaust a bit of manslaughter either, right? Okay, we'll come back to that. It follows, therefore, that in here, between doing and being, is not necessity, but contingency. Precisely because it's beyond control. So there is a contingency between doing and what is done, between doing and being. And we have to be lucky that in important circumstances, what we intend and what happens do connect. All action, however, is subject to systematic misfiring. it's subject to systematic reappropriation by the other. What we do and what is done are in different registers. Now, it so happens in the real world that if you disown everything that occurs, even though you did not intend it, you will be responsible for almost nothing. So the liberal idea of the individual is the individual who is responsible for almost nothing. And that's the way they want it. Nietzsche despises backward-looking emotions, but, and I won't do the argument here, I'll do it later in the semester, I reckon that such emotions, regret, remorse, and the like, are what make us human. Nonetheless, there is something about being and feeling responsible and acting accordingly that is part of what it means to be an agent in a certain type of social space. That is, what the individualist account ignores is any sense that context is constitutive of both the meaning and the potential justification for an action. That context, you might say, has a meaning constitutive and thereby a justification constitutive role in the understanding of action. Well, this model of disparities is brought up for the first time at this moment, although I'm suggesting now it's going to become Hegel's hobby horse in the chapters that follow. And that there is a necessary detachment of the work from the doing. Works are essentially detachable from the deeds from which they come about. That, let's say, works lack the very mindness that makes action action, at least on the liberal account. It follows from this that there is a necessary contingency in all action, but, and this is now Hegel's next argument, but if all action possesses a contingent relationship to what is done, that is, if there's a contingency about the relation between intention and result, then the necessity of that contingency belongs to the logic of action. So, therefore, this contingency, which is the initial datum we're thinking about here, is in some sense sublated. If contingency is necessary, then it's no longer contingent. That is, we have to bring that into the meaning of the action, namely actions routinely do not bring about the results they intend. Now, it's at just this moment that Bittner wants to step in. And I'll explain why. Hegel agrees that once we recognize that our acts can misfire, then we can just live with it. There is, in a sense, nothing more to be said. This form of consciousness takes into itself the necessity of the contingency of failure. The real thing, the matter at hand, the thing itself, if you wish, is what I truly intended, whether it happens or not. Via the real thing, I console myself about misfirings. Bittner says, nonsense. We do not, he says, have to follow Hegel here. That is, we do not have to accept, let's call it real thing idealism, because, Bittner says, real men, i.e. we Aristotelians, real men, do not need consolation about the failure of action. Once Hegel agrees that actions do routinely fail, and incorporates it in our understanding of action, then we can simply stop there and say, that's all there is to be said. There is nothing more than prudential reasoning. Of course there's routine failure, but hey, we're all grown-ups now, and that's the end of the discussion. But Hegel, and this is the response to Bittner, is not supposing, Hegel is not supposing that what the prudential reasoner needs is consolation. And that's not the issue he's interested in. The real thing doctrine does not acknowledge the problem of separation. So what is called the outside, the real thing, is still now determined by the first person perspective. What is not recognized, and what I'm now claiming Bittner does not recognize either, because he adopts simply the word contingency as a hold-all for all these problems, is the third person or social point of view. The intrinsic for another of my action. So what the prudential reasoner does is simply say that the gap between doing and being is to be understood as a problem of contingency, which we can just live with, and ignores the question of the relationship between first person and third person points of view. Prudential reasoning does want both its particular, my doing, and its universal moment connected. But there is an imbalance or disparity in the notion of the real thing. The real thing is either too private or too public. Either it is my thing, in which case the third person drops out altogether, I have done it, and its goodness is attached to me, and all universality drops out. Or it is too public, because we all claim it as my real thing. Agency drops out. And that's the meaning of that strange paragraph 418. Where Hegel says, a consciousness that opens up a subject matter soon learns that others hurry along like flies to freshly poured milk, and want to busy themselves with it. And they learn about that individual that he too is concerned with the subject matter, not as an object, but as his own affair. On the other hand, so the problem here is there is no work. There is no work. On the other hand, if what is supposed to be essential is merely the doing of it, the employment of powers and capacities, or the expression of this particular individuality, then equally it is learned by all parties that they all regard themselves as affected and invited to participate, and instead of a mere doing or separate action, peculiar to the individual who opened up the subject matter, something has been opened up that is for others as well, and is a subject matter on its own account. Prudential reasoning cannot actually put together the for me and the for another of an action. The real thing is, in fact, nothing but a projection of Geist into an abstract ideality. That is, it is a certain taking up of sociality into an individual sphere and ignoring the fact of its very sociality. If the real thing is simply an illusory projection, then what is wrong with prudential agency is that it wants a universal, but it does not know what a universal is. Action always has in some sense the status of being for another. That in the very doing of it, it is always already a being for another. So the problem with this structure is it took the being for self and being for another structure and thought you could neatly divide those moments in two and then ask how they might be hooked up or fail to be hooked up, not seeing that any action has a moment in it of being for others, not just immediately, but immediately. Which is to say, immediately the subject is not subject, and the object not object. Put it another way, immediately that I act, I am in the action itself passing beyond my own subjectivity and assuming a relationship to another. And Hegel thinks, and this is the transition to the next moment, Hegel thinks that this is exactly what a certain type of moral universalism correctly understood. That is, what he's thinking of here are those people who think that just like there are mathematical radical truths of reason, when I add 2 plus 2 equals 4, I'm not doing a private act. I'm already, right, in the world of universality. My thinking is already a universal thinking. Well, why shouldn't it be the case that there are truths of reason in the moral domain that have the same status as mathematical truths? Why isn't something like tell the truth, keep your promises, treat your neighbor as thyself, etc., etc., all these traditional moral principles? After all, and plainly amongst other people thinking of Locke, Locke says, just by simple reflection, people will be able to grasp these moral truths. They do not need demonstration. They have the same immediate access to reasoning as the simplest mathematical truths. And even Hobbes, who disagreed about their status, thought that as well. He thought these were just there. And those are the empiricists, the rationalists, of course, want to go even further. So even the empiricists think this is the case. So this is the notion of reason as law giver, the next moment. Hegel defines this, paragraph 422, by saying, since self-consciousness knows itself to be a moment of the being for self of this substance, it expresses the existence of the law within itself as follows. Sound reason knows immediately what is right and good. Just as it knows the law immediately, so too the law is valid for it immediately. It says directly, this is right and good. And moreover, this particular law. The laws are determinate. The law is the matter at hand, the real thing, and has itself filled with significance. What is surprising about this in the next moment is how quickly Hegel dispatches them. Even though you would have thought these would be high moments of modern enlightened morality. And they indeed are ideas that continue to have moral persuasion. Well, what's the problem with reason as law giver? And the question being asked here, are there universal moral truths? And statements like, tell the truth itself be true in the way that 2 plus 2 plus 4 is true. Well, of course we know Hegel is a kind of Aristotelian, but you might think, well, even Aristotle thought there was some moral truth, so that won't take us very far. How's Hegel going to confront this problem? Well, where does he think the problem is? And he, here at least, the argument is not always as clear as it might be. He says the problem with universalistic moral truths, he calls, or we can call, the problem of application. And this is, the problem of application is simply, I mean, this is massive. I mean, there are those, like Habermas, who think there are really are universalistic moral truths, and those who think, because of the application problem, there are not. So this argument, although very brief here, is absolutely fundamental to even contemporary debates in moral philosophy. Well, Hegel, in paragraph 424, puts it this way. I won't read the whole thing, but I'll just open it up and then I'll elaborate a bit. Take a moral truth. Everyone ought to speak the truth. Hegel goes on to say, in this duty as expressed unconditionally, the condition will at once be admitted. If he knows the truth, the commandment then will now run, everyone ought to speak the truth at all times according to his knowledge and conviction. And then the argument's going to proceed that way. That is, the question here is, and I want to put the question very, very precisely, do we know the meaning, literally the meaning, of universalistic moral truths independently of their application to concrete circumstances? So the question would be, put the same question again another way, is can there be universalist moral truths? Well, roughly, Hegel's argument here is you can only know the meaning of a moral truth if and only if you know how to apply it in this instance. The force of the norm is idle on its own account. So, to take an example slightly different from Hegel's, but one that's very important in Kant because it concerns what he calls wide obligations, Kant thinks there's a wide obligation, a general norm, act beneficently. That is, help others who are in need. All others? Every single one? Can't mean that, right? How much need do they have to be in? A little bit of need or a lot of need? Do I have to help others in need, even if I'm in need? We go on and on and on and on. If we start pressing this thought, it turns out that it's hollow on its own, that it has no authority. But if that's the case, and now here's the deep thing, not only is the meaning essentially indeterminate, you might be able to live with that and say, well, you have to learn how to apply it. But that can't be right, because the question is, what's the authority of the law. It's supposed to be morally overriding in some sense. It's supposed to be a law. But on its own, the law is empty and commands nothing. Only, and here's the contrary thesis, only via its connection to actual circumstances does it acquire actual meaning. But if the case is only via actual circumstances does it acquire actual meaning, then you might say that the source of obligation, the source of the obligation, is not in the law itself, but at least in part, and I would say more than in part, in the circumstances themselves. That it's the circumstances that, so it's finding oneself actually in circumstances where someone's bleeding, no one else is around. Now, is it the case that when I apply a tourniquet, I'm applying a tourniquet because I believe in the law act beneficially, or because they're bleeding? Is the ground of my action the events that call it forth and reveal by calling it forth what beneficial action is, with the source, the miracle? My suggestion is, if you are bleeding, you would think that the fact that you're bleeding, I want to be very careful here, is the reason I should help you. And not because you are bleeding and I believe in the law act beneficially and I can see that you are an instance of the law. You might think, to use a phrase of Bernard Bloom's, that I have one reason too many here. That if I need all that reason, something's gone wrong, namely, I've missed out on you. Right? The thing about moral laws, you might say, at that level of abstraction, is it looks as if we exist for the sake of the law rather than the law existing for the sake of us and our needs. So the moral realist is going to argue, a certain type of moral realist, is going to argue that the mean, that moral only concrete moral statements about particular cases can have a truth value, can be true or false, and that universals act beneficially, have no truth value whatsoever. And if they have no truth value, equally, they have no bindings. They do not obligate. I work out in my Adorno book, just if any of you are interested in this kind of stuff, I beat this argument to death. And I label inelegantly, as always, the view that I want to support, namely only concrete cases can be morally true or false, what I call the indexical binding of moral norms. That all moral norms arise out of particular cases and must return to cases in order to have any authority, and that moral reasoning moves from case to case and not from abstract universals to particular cases. Right? That universalism works, as we say, laterally rather than, or horizontally rather than vertically. Well, if that's the case, what are the status of moral principles, since we've always have had them? Now, of course, we know why we've always had them, because we have assumed that truth and time are incompatible. We have assumed that only what is, nothing can be true that is not eternally true, and nothing can be binding that is not eternally resourced, right? That's why we want commands to come from God, right? You know, do not covet thy neighbor's wife. Now, exactly why God saying that should stop my covetousness, right, has never seems to me to be completely unintelligible. And I want to say that that's the secret of moral theology. It makes the source of norms unintelligible and hopes that no one will notice. Because of a certain anxiety, right? But if that's true, what is the status of moral principles? Well, I think they are two things that can be said about them. I don't want to say that we don't. I'm not claiming they don't exist. I'm claiming they do exist and they're lateral. But how about, you know, if universals on their own tell the truth, are not themselves true or false, what do they do? What's their function? First, I mean, obviously they are mnemonic devices. They are a way of reproducing, right, traditional knowledge that we, as it were, socialize people in telling them what we have found in our culture to be a useful thing worth remembering, namely, tell the truth. But then the other thing is, well then, how, if they're just mnemonic devices for reproducing the tradition, how do they help us out? And here I think they have an inelimitable function. Namely, they function as orientations to provide attention. As they tell us the sorts of things to remember and attend to, not what are going to be true or false, but what we need to be on the lookout for and think about and deliberate about in routine sets of circumstances. So they govern, I'd want to say, our forms of attention. Yeah?
Would you say the same thing about laws concerning natural phenomena? So water boils, ceteris paribus, at 100 degrees Celsius, right? Alter altitude, and that's going to change, right? And I mean, you seem to be wanting to make the same kind of argument about moral laws, but it doesn't seem to be that natural laws are mnemonic devices.
Ah, why not? Nancy Cartwright thinks they are. In a book called Why the Laws of Physics Lie, she just offers exactly the argument you just offered. She says there really aren't no laws of physics. They are certain types of idealizations that help us structure, orient, set up circumstances, and that in the why world of contingency, no. So she thinks that, I mean, so there is a way, a certain way, of thinking that the belief that there are laws of physics is a certain type of reductionism and Platonism. So if you are Heidegger seems to me to get physics about right. What does Heidegger say? Heidegger says, you know, it's all about presence to hand and ready to hand. He says, look, objects normally are ready to hand. Right? That is, they're part of the circuit of practices and uses. But we can take them out of that context and place them in another context. We call that other context science. Science operates by a decontextualization of ordinary objects and a recontextualization of it into the laboratory, the world of theory, which operates a series of idealizations for very good reasons. I'm not saying there aren't good reasons. Without it, we couldn't, you know, turn on the lights. Right? We have all the reasons in the world, but it doesn't mean there are really laws of physics. That is, that's a certain belief in the correspondence theory of truth. Namely, here's the laws, and there are the structures out there that they represent. I don't think so. I mean, it's a matter of debate. I mean, I'm more of a scientific realist than most people, but at least there is a deep analogy.
I guess one of the things that I'm concerned about is if it turns out that both any kind of epistemological understanding of universality is going to collapse into a kind of mnemonic attunement to various social situations,
right?
Then there's no difference between, and maybe this is the point, there's no difference between knowing something and acting upon it, but if there's no difference, then you can't have the kind of contingency between the four myself and for another of my action, right? Because presumably when I'm acting upon something, I have a particular kind of understanding of what's going on, and that might be at odds with what you see me doing, right? And vice versa. And if we were to sit down and talk about, well, you know, I thought you were doing this, we would appeal to a particular kind of epistemological framework, which is not necessarily, I think, constrained by a particular kind of mnemonic attunement to the situation at hand, right?
Like what?
A particular attunement to the situation. So I might have a very different understanding based on a particular scientific belief of what a particular situation calls for, which might be at odds with what you think, right? And we can talk about that independent of the actual action.
Well, we can, except that what I want to say is that the scientific theory is just an account of a certain type of context. And that to ask someone to consider things in a scientific light, as I think we should very often, is simply to say, look, if you really want to understand what's really happening here, the notion of really happening, then ignore the immediate context and think of a different kind of context. That is, eliminate all sorts of other considerations. That's okay, right? So, and that has levels. So we know that for lots of practical purposes, indeed almost all practical purposes, we can be Newtonians. Right? But in fact, so the Newtonian is just a way of a special case. So it's not clear to me. Now, of course, there's another set of issues which Hegel doesn't address, namely whether we should think of the laws of physics and moral life on analogy with one another. And here's the disanalogy. And the disanalogy is that the objects of physical theory, as far as we can make out, are unchanging. While the objects of moral thought are historical. So roughly, something happens, and I suggest it happens with the introduction of life, that changes whether or not structures are temporal or atemporal. But there's at least an argument which justifies a certain way of thinking about physics and says, well, look, the reason we want a certain type of physical theory, that is one that is essentially context-free, is because we think there's a stratum of material structures that really does exist independently of circumstance. And it makes sense to abstract that out and consider that as relatively stable. And I don't think that will get you correspondence. I think that makes all sorts of other assumptions about mathematics, about the use of modeling in physics, I mean, all sorts of systems, but at least that gives the difference between physics and everything else a bit of leverage. Okay.
Any questions about moral truth before we turn to Kant? Yeah. I'm finding moral truth a hard time.
I guess I sort of want to start out by saying I think I'm kind of on the side of, like I'm finding Hegel pretty convincing. What I'm kind of worried about it is whether if we switch the phrasing of what's supposed to be universal moral law around to a prohibition instead of a positive command, like he's saying, you know, tell the truth. If it's given a more of a negative wording, whether the same argument works, because it seems like if the law is don't kill, there might not be the same sort of problem in applying it, because anytime I want to kill, the law says don't do that.
Why is that going to help? I can think of lots of circumstances. I'm happy to kill them.
I guess what I'm really asking...
Well, no, someone's going to attack my kid, I'll kill him! You know, so, I mean, there are lots of circumstances. Now, we have accounts of this. We call it self-defense. We call it war. We have complicated rules. So the notion of don't kill doesn't say what we want it to say. What we want to say is don't kill innocent people who are just walking along for no reason at all because you don't like the look of their eyebrows. Now, I just had my eyebrows trimmed by the barber, right? So I'm a nervous guy. I don't want to take any chances. But, you know, I mean, it really isn't... It's the same problem that's going to happen with the negative. Don't lie? Well, this is, you know, the literature around Kant's, you know, always tell the truth, and he said, you know, tell the truth when you're protecting an innocent person and the bastards are at the door and you say, I cannot tell a lie, he's hiding in the closet. Manny, lie! Right? He doesn't get it, right? He doesn't get the conditionality. So the problem of the thought of morality, what Kant wants, what these guys want, and now Kant's going to want, is morality to be unconditional. And Hegel's, if I have one sentence to summarize all of Hegel, the only unconditional truth for Hegel is that all truth is conditional. Yeah?
So, I mean, Kant makes use of the doing-being distinction that Hegel has, too, by saying that all you can control is the intentions, right? Because the man in the closet could just as well run out of the window and murderer will find him outside.
So, Susan Neyman, in this wonderful essay on Arendt, says, look, the idea that the only good thing in the world is a goodwill, and it's, you know, it shines like a jewel in the dark, isn't that Kant's phrase? Looks great, except if the shining is, you know, all by itself. But what happens if, when you're shining in your jewel-like intention, and your neighbor is being deported? Then it looks pretty hollow. I don't care about your intention. I care about your deed, what you do. And if you didn't protect the person who was being deported, saying, yeah, but I really intended well, I was following the moral law, I would say, you know, see a therapist, get some help, join the world, do some reality testing. You know, I mean, of course I'm being cute here, but that's where it's going to kick in.
I want to ask if we're bending the stick too far the other way, but you tell me if this is just coming down the line and we're going to get to it. This idea that, okay, I intend to do something, but I do something and it goes hideously awry, and we say, okay, that's what you really intended to do.
No, that's what hits the awry.
I mean, it's...
No, we're not trying to deny there are intentions. We're simply suggesting that the domain of responsibility, as we'll see, doesn't stop with intentions. And that furthermore, that certain types of unintended consequences are massively culpable, but certain others... Let me use an example, the Bernard Williams example, just to give you some hint here about how things might go. And one's intuitions here. There's a literature around this called the problem of moral luck. And there's a ton of debates between Bernard Williams and Tom Nagel. And here's a simple case. You know, I'm driving along, going on the speed limit, all that sort of stuff. Someone jaywalks in front of me, I kill them. Williams wants to say, I did nothing intentionally wrong, but I would be a monster if I did not feel remorse and regret, if I did not offer my apologies to the victim's family, if... So feeling responsible here, now one can feel guilty in a crazy way, but feeling responsible here is feeling that I have been connected through no fault of my own, but it's me who has been connected with this event. And I can't fully detach the fact that it was me who did it, even though I did nothing morally false. Now, as we'll kind of come to see for Hegel and Schelling, this is what tragic hero and heroines are all about, that they affirm their freedom even when they have been fated to do something. A tragic responsibility. So, do we want to say, wouldn't it be odd if I felt nothing that I killed someone? And getting it right, I want to say, here's all I need for my case. I don't think there's any fully right response here. I don't want the individual who did this to feel guilty for the rest of their life, take to the bottle, never drive that car again, be permanently traumatized, although that happened to a friend of mine, and never break down. Because he worse was a cop. Backed up. Okay. That would be wrong, but as it would be completely wrong to say, oh well, you know, calls the ambulance, dries off, nothing to do with me. We have some sense that our agency in the world matters, and our doings matter, above and beyond our intentions, and that the way in which our intentions relate to this is, I just want to put it this way, complicated. I'll say more about those complications as we go on. But all I need for now is to say, look, you can't go either way. And the imagination that we can go either way is, of course, is what makes some people Kantians and some utilitarians, and, you know, a pox on both their houses. Well, the next transition is to Kant. And the thought here, I want to do this and then we'll take the break and then I'll try to do the transition. This is the last moment of reason. So the thought is, unaided reason cannot immediately know the content of moral truths. But there is a certain form, a certain form all true moral truths must share. Namely, they must be logically consistent. And the idea of consistency in action is that moral actions must be universalizable. And this was, of course, Kant's idea of the moral law. That reason doesn't give you the content, but gives you the form. Therefore, reason tests moral maxims for their moral validity. So the categorical imperative is a principle of consistency in action. The person who gets, the two people who get this right in their writings about Kant are Nora O'Neill and Christine Korsgaard. I think both their writings are mad dog Kantians, but they're deep and thoughtful mad dog Kantians. I say that in a friendly way. O'Neill's I used to teach a course on Kant and Hegel with her for about 15 years, so I know this argument well. So, on Kant's analysis, the categorical imperative is really a testing procedure. And what you do is take your subjective maxim, that is, the principle you are acting on. I will always do X in these types of situations. And then run it through a hypothetical test. And the test says, well, now imagine a world in which everyone would act on that maxim in those kind of procedures. And as you do the adjustments and imagine such a possible world, the question is, does it work out okay? So to take a simple example, the one that Kant uses over and over again, I have as my maxim, I will break my promises as convenient. No one really wants to be bound by their promises. Okay, now imagine a world in which everybody breaks their promises as convenient. And Kant says, if you imagine that happening, and you imagine the expectable empirical consequences of that, so Kant includes empirical consequences as what it is to act in accordance with the maxim. Empirical consequences matter for Kant. Indeed, that's he thinks about almost nothing else in a certain way. He says, if you imagine a world like that, then what you imagine is a world in which pretty soon no one would believe people's promises because they knew, as a matter of induction, that if it was inconvenient for you to keep that promise, that is, I lent you $10,000, it's just not convenient to return it yet. Well, I'm not going to lend anyone any money, right? Because I can't rely on them doing it. Now, that's not the problem. The problem is not that it's an impossible world. It's now there's a contradiction, and this is what Kant means to be testing, because between my maxim and the world that results, namely, I'm assuming a world in which people do keep their promises, and my maxim, right, is a free rider on other people's goodwill. So what the categorical imperative test, and it really does capture this, is whether or not I am making an exception in my own case. That is, the idea of universalizability is that whatever I do must truly be doable by everyone. And that if it is not truly doable by everyone, then in my doing it, I am a free rider. That is, I am saying the law applies to everyone except me. And therefore, for Kant, the height of immorality is making an exception in your own case. Well, that sounds pretty good. And what then is going to be Hegel's problem with it? And Hegel has what's called, and he does it better in both the Essay on Natural Law and in the Philosophy of Right, but he does it here very quickly. It's what in the literature is called the emptiness problem. Can there be any really determinate moral maxims?
So
what is that problem and what's Hegel worried about? So the first thing I want to say, just so I don't want to be misunderstood, is Hegel never denies the principle of universality. He thinks, on the contrary, not is it true, but he thinks it's trivially true, which is going to be the problem. He thinks it's morally uninteresting. Above all, he's going to argue, it's not the source, the principle of universality is not the source of moral validity. Why? Well, the example that he beats to death here is don't steal. And sure enough, you know, so I have the principle, I'll steal as convenient. That's a pretty attractive principle. And we can see that that will break down in all the ways I indicated that the other principle will break down. Namely, pretty soon, you know, people are going to be deeply untrustworthy, guns are going to be out, no one's going to, you know, everyone's going to... But Hegel says, wait a minute, there's a problem here. He says the problem is, well, think of it this way. How about if I'm really, really, really hungry? Is it okay to steal then? Well, you say, no. If you steal then, you know, you're destroying the institution of property. Oh, and now comes the Hegel point. So we have an institution in place that says that I ought to go hungry. The problem, Hegel says, is do not steal assumes the goodness of the institution of private property. But why should we have an institution of private property? So his thought is, and here's where he thinks it's trivially true, he says, look, if you have an institution of private property, of course you have the obligation, don't steal. That's just what it means to have the institution of private property. That stealing is wrong. That's built into the institution. What the categorical imperative does not tell us is the real thing we need to know, namely, should we have an institution of private property at all? Why not have an institution of communal property? Why not have an institution where no property is owned by anyone, but people have various access to various properties? There are literally, although our imagination has been dimmed by capital, dozens of ways of thinking about how to handle our needing to use particular items. Private property is just one of them. Now, if that's true, then the maxim
then by itself, the moral law can never provide us with a determinate maxim. Because at the end of the day, all our actions are going to be parasitic upon the institutions that are the conveyors of those practices. So the categorical imperative is empty not because there's anything wrong with universality. Hegel agrees with Kant. To act, all action is legislative. All action is legislative. To act is to say that everyone can ought to act in the same way. Otherwise, you don't mean what you're doing, right? Whenever we act, we assume our action is right. If we assume our action is right, then we are legislators. So universality is built into the meaning of action. You cannot do an action and say, this is right for me, but for no one else in the universe, and no one else in the universe is allowed to do it. Because then it's not right for you either. You can't, as it were, think of action as so primitive and unique. The very notion of action now is for another. Right? So action has built into it that for another. That is, it's legislative. To do it is to do it as right or good or proper. The issue is that our actions always ride piggyback on our social practices. And it's only our social practices that we have. Wait a minute. Where did that word come from? It's because of the practice. Suddenly the word we is now become operative. We have already instituted, and by instituting, tacitly approved of, agreed to, legislated the institution of private property. So it's because we have, in some sense, and this is the sense we have to dig and find out about, because we have always already instituted this institution of private property and vindicated it, it's because of that stealing is wrong. But, and now the question comes, exactly how did we do that? Exactly what institutions have we approved of? And exactly why have we approved of them? Hegel's claim is there is, if I can put it this way, no universality without generality. Where by generality, I mean social generality. That is, the origins of determinacy and bindingness are in our shared practices, and any individual actions we might commit, no matter what they are, already depend upon having already agreed to inhabit this shared world with others. So the thought is that universality is not an abstract, eternal thing up there. It's a lower level thing, namely what we do. So it's our practices that give determinacy to moral maxims. Yeah?
Are trying to understand what you're saying in relation to what you said earlier about source of obligation being the actual circumstances. It seems, maybe I'm misunderstanding, but now that the source of obligation is not the actual circumstance, but the shared value in which this actual circumstance is an example of, or a simple, or a business of.
Absolutely right. Okay. So we have what's interesting about Kant. Is that the kind of moral phenomena he seems to be able to deal with well are phenomena that are concerned with shared practices. So all his examples turn on do not lie, keep your promises. That is forms of activity that are themselves already institution bound. The things that he does not talk about, when you read Kant, and this should be puzzling, he never talks about don't kill, don't murder, don't punch people in the face. I mean, he never talks about what Barbara Herman calls murder and mayhem. Now, it's kind of puzzling. And I have to tell you that the article on murder and mayhem is a fascinating article because it's a Kantian struck by a kind of embarrassment that really the major sorts of moral issues, right, namely those concerning violence, are absent. So what I want to say to you in response is that there is a difference between, let's call it, the institutionally shared practices and the way they're normatively regulated and the ones concerned with, let's call it, bodily integrity. And we might say that that's the difference between the moral and the political. So that in the case, I mean, I still will want to argue, and Hegel will want to argue, that for most moral cases, the source of obligation is the relationship to the other, but there are a range of cases that are obviously institution-bound. That is, the notion of property just is a social institution, and therefore always going to be a matter of a we thing. So you're right to detect a slight gap here, and just not to put a too fine a point on it, you're going to discover that this is the very gap between Antigone and Creon. And we come to... Right, so Hegel's going to be really thinking about this problem between particular and universal. Yeah?
I was just wondering if maybe the problem is similar to the one between origin and validity that we saw with a certain reason, in the sense that the authority of a norm stems from the concrete particular instantiation of whatever.
Right.
Whereas the validity of a particular norm is the institutional framework that then sanctions various kinds of aspects.
Right.
And in a sense, never the twain shall meet. There's always a problem in terms of justifying why a particular course of action is morally legitimate, on the one hand, versus why an institutional structure is valid. And on the other hand, it seems like I don't actually ever agree with a particular institution. I just throw it into it.
That's right. And Hegel wants to think about that. Right.
So there's sort of that gap of contingency that seems to widen here. And I'm not sure
if that's going to be problematic?
No, it's going to turn out to be, and this is where I'm going to be going to in the next hour if we have time, that for much more of moral and political life than we think, validation is retrospective. That Kantian reason wants to think, you know, O'Neill and I, when we'd argue, she would say over and over again, morality is not a spectator sport. It's for participants, and therefore we want moral rules and principles that are action guiding. And Hegel is going to try to convince us that there can be, and I'm going to try to convince you, maybe today, maybe not today, I guess, that there cannot be unconditional rules that are action guiding. And there cannot be unconditional rules or action guiding for a very simple reason. Results. That results matter to the meaning and being of the action. So that there's built into the problem of action a certain afterwardsness that cannot be undone. And that the imagination, and this is terribly important, the imagination that we should have a moral theory that should tell us what to do, whatever the circumstances, is a certain type of moral fantasy. Namely, we want moral certainty that we're doing the right thing. The whole point of the phenomenology, keep saying the whole point, here's another one, is to say, but to say, it's actually the same thought I already said, there's no unconditionality. That's the same as saying there's no certainty. There may be moral truth, but there's no moral certainty. So what is disappointing about Hegel, and I'll say a lot about why philosophy as a whole is disappointing at the end of the course. You don't want to hear that now, do you? You're going to tell me after 30 weeks it's disappointing? That nothing can give us a grounding in the world that will make it okay. That philosophy can't solve the problem of how to live a good life for you, i.e. by giving you a set of rules that you need a bit of prudence, a bit of phronesis, and you'll be fine. It doesn't work that way. That life is just more difficult than that. And even, right, even Heidegger, you know, the reason I find Heidegger such a fraud, no, is he wants to be authentic. So you can be an authentic Nazi or authentic anti. What's that about, right? The notion of authenticity is another notion of moral certainty. And one way of thinking about that is it's a refusal of tragedy. It's a refusal to think that life has, let's call it, an inelimitable tragic dimension. Let me, I mean, it's already 7:30, so I think I'll just rattle on another 20 minutes or so. We're not going to even get very far. But let's get a little ways on. What is idealism after Kant? That's one way of asking the question. What happens to idealism after Kant? And the simplest thing I can say, and this will just make the transition easier for you, and then I'll explain it, is that everyone agreed there was something limited about Kantian rationalism. And when they thought about there was something limited about Kantian rationalism, they all, I mean Schiller and Hölderlin and Schelling, all of them had the same thought. Rees,
they all thought that this is the famous German love of the Greeks, that something about the Greek form of life was a corrective to Kantianism. So in a certain way, when Hegel goes from Kant to Greece, he's not just, as it were, arbitrarily moving, he's actually tracking the movement of German idealism itself. The German idealism literally went from Kant to Greece. Now I have to make sense of that and make sense of all that involves. So, first, Kant's achievement. Kant broke with the Enlightenment idea of rational choice. That is, when I say Enlightenment, I mean of Hume, of Adam Smith, of all these characters, of Shaftesbury, of all the characters that we've been looking at up until Reason is Law. He broke with all of them when he decided that the rational choice of maxims was not something that could emerge from natural dispositions. That Enlightenment rationalism before Kant really thought that nature was benevolent, right? We saw that with Shaftesbury, and that a certain type of naturalism would do the trick, that our natural dispositions would take care of it all. Kant, on the contrary, recognized that only an act could be moral only if it was an act of free self-determination. And to be an act of free self-determination, it had to be fully independent of external grounds. So, Kant said, and the first philosopher who made Plato say, Kant said, the having of a desire is not a reason for action. The mere having of a desire, I'd like a cupcake, that's not a reason to go have a cupcake. In order for my desire for a cupcake to be a reason for action, I must take it and accept it as a reason for action. That is, I must, as it were, freely endorse it. And to freely endorse it is to see if it is compatible with the moral law. So the thought is only the moral law, which is pure form, is the only thing. So the idea of the moral law now is it's something that's totally free of natural determination. And only if I can act in accordance with the moral law can I know, this is Kant's great thought, can I know if I can act in accordance with the moral law, then I can know that my action is mine, because if I can't know that, then there might be a secret cause, a natural disposition working its way through me, right? And then I wouldn't be me that was acting, it would be the natural cause. It would be my ravenous desire for cupcakes. I was acting and not me. So if I want to have a cupcake, I have to take it. That the maxim, I shall eat a cupcake when I want to, is okay. So for Kant, the autonomy of the will, the freedom of the will is self-determining, the autonomy of morality, that is the separation of the moral from nature, the autonomy of moral morality, and the autonomy of reason, those three things mutually implicate one another. That they are mutually reinforcing. So Kant really is about autonomy, that we must be free self-legislators. unless this is Kant thought this thought through more radically than anyone else. Although it picks up obviously on Platonism, but Kant saw the impetus of it. Unless reason could demonstrably be free of the authority of nature, desire, unless reason could be demonstrably free of the authority of nature, the will could not be free. And if the will's not free, then who's acting? Right? And Kant had the wonderful thought that we are not dummies, right? That we are not machines that simply carry out natural inclinations. Now, that this is finally a bit of magical Platonism, of what my old supervisor, W.H. Walsh, used to call news from nowhere, metaphysics.
It's a wonderful book on metaphysics. He calls metaphysics news from nowhere.
He says that's what the positivist thought of all metaphysics. It was news from nowhere. But that Collins really is news from nowhere, as Terry Pinker rightly said, is implied by the fact of reason. Because the fact of reason is to say there is reason, but it's a fact. Right? And he just goes in this circle of both wanting reason to be self-determining and at the same time wanting it to be unconditional. And therefore, it pivots between a pure abstraction and an utterly intransigent factuality. Reason turns out to be just another given in Kant. The moral, that's what the idea of the fact of reason in the Second Critique says is that I immediately experience in action the moral law as authoritative for me. And the evidence for this for Kant, which is perfectly good evidence, he says the evidence for this is simply the experience of temptation. But he means by this not temptation to bad, but temptation to good. That is, that we ever have a hesitancy about doing the wrong thing. Right? So Kant gives the example, right? A bizarre example, but I think it's an example of a brothel across the street. And he says, in that brothel, he says, you know, I will find, you know, my happiness satisfied, you know, goes through this whole story, and then I won't be satisfied if I lie, there's this whole story. And he says, if for a moment I can conceive, I would do the right thing, then I know the moral law exists. So it's the experience, right? And that's all Kant thinks he needs, of the experience of the gap between is and ought. That, for him, shows that the fact of reason is real. No suggestions there might be some social training involved, that we may have introduced, none of that, right? Just the fact of reason itself does all the work. Okay. Now, so Kant has this radical form-content duality. And in my view, Kant, in a way, has the worst of both worlds. He has a Platonism of reason and a determinism of nature. I mean, how did he get both? Making it look as if we're determined from both sides. We both have these natural desires we can't escape. And whenever I teach Kant to first-year students, they say, am I free not to obey the moral law? You know, they feel it as a kind of, you know, oppressive, you know, bad parent. Well, Kant was correct, Hegel thinks, in seeing that reason-giving must be self-authenticating. We cannot set the reason we can call Hegel an idealist is he thinks that we do not point to moral truth. We have to vindicate it from within. That there is no given. There's no outside to reason and reasoning in Hegel. So something like the idea of self-determination and self-authentication seems right. But Kant did not have the apparatus to do this properly. Hegel argues that without any appeal to what has become authoritative for a specific community, nor to what in that community's accounts of why what it has taken as authoritative really is genuinely authoritative, no determinate set of moral principles can be generated. That is, Hegel thinks, just to
say that too quick, eh? I think that looked like, come on, get a little rest. Hegel takes it that A, moral principles come into being. They are not shot from a pistol, they do not come from nowhere. So there's an account of a becoming. And not only an account of becoming, but an account of why we have accepted those truths that have become as authoritative for us. And only the putting together of those two things, that is, the history of the becoming and the history of communal authentication, can provide for moral determinacy. The Kantian project, with its insistence on formal self-authenticating reason, detaches reason from all empirical, natural, and social events. So Kant, as it were, goes too far in every direction. And because he does, he can't take account of what really empirically is there for us. Namely, we have these natural dispositions, and we have these social dispositions. And it's in virtue of them that determinate content to our actions occurs. So reason, and this is, I guess, Hegel's discovery, reason must be transformed from an ahistorical, transcendent standard into an account of how agents could come to evaluate these modern practices, scientific, moral, political, economic, domestic, in terms of whether they fit the historically developing standards of rationality themselves, and with reason being able to show why these putatively valid standards do not themselves generate further skeptical problems. So the thought is, again, that the way in which we're going to come to understand ourselves is to understand ourselves as having come to adopt reason is going to be concrete. It's going to be scientific reason, it's going to be political reason, it's going to be economic reason, it's going to be the nuclear family, it's going to be, so we have all these modern institutions. They are reason in its concreteness. And Hegel is going to say that we have to come to understand how these developing ideas of reason have come about, how
how we understand them as valid for us, and further think of them as not generating any further skeptical doubts. Although it has become massively unfashionable, there is no way we can make ourselves intelligible to ourselves without some version of a philosophy of history, and Hegel thinks a progressive philosophy of history. Right? That come what may, we are stuck with the problem of the philosophy of history. That is, we have to compare our standards and practices with respect to earlier standards and practices, and come to think of our standards and practices as either an advance or a collapse. One or the other, you know? Or maybe a little bit of both. But you cannot avoid, as Lyotard and people like that want to avoid, philosophy of history. That is, you can't avoid grand narratives. You can't avoid grand narratives because there are institutions. And either the capitalist economy is progressive with respect to the feudal economy, or it ain't, or maybe again it's both. Again, you know, maybe democracy, you know, democracy has to be put in relation to the absolutist state, the nuclear family in relation to the extended family, natural science in relationship to medieval scientific practices. We can't avoid asking those questions because, apart from them, there is no reasoning. We reason always about objects in places in context. Hegel, of course, does think, for reasons I'll come to, this is what spirit's going to be. Spirit's going to be a kind of progressive philosophy of history. It's going to show that certain types of movement forward were necessary in order, what? To solve concrete social problems in reason. And that we develop the standards we have in a problem-solving way, and therefore to generate more adequate standards of rationality. So generally, the claim is going to be that existing social practices must be integrated into an account of what an autonomous, self-conscious agent could come to count as valid for herself. And if this were to be done, then modern life would have to come to be constituted as an ethical substance, as a form of life in which Sittlichkeit, which roughly means in Hegel the way things are done, would be compatible with a sense of subjects taking the way things are done, practices we actually have, with the way in which or at least continuous with a sense of subjects freely choosing those ends. To state this in hyperbolic terms, I see you're puzzled. Let me see if I can draw a picture here. My claim is that Hegel wants to provide a perfect synthesis of Burke and Nietzsche. Let me explain why, and then we'll call it a day. I can explain why. Why did I write that? It was early this morning when I wrote it. But I think it's a nice image. Roughly, he wants to affirm the former's traditionalism, but wants to argue that such traditionalism becomes a determinism of history if the practices forming our life together cannot be rationally vindicated and conceived of as self-determined. Roughly, you can't be a pure Burkean, because if you're a pure Burkean, the only reason to accept things is because that's the way things are. And that's just traditionalism. Right? Burke wants to say we can't abstract ourselves from history. That's Burke's great insight. That there's a conservative moment in Burke, and the conservative moment is there's something right about the claim, and this is his critique of the French Revolution, we cannot step outside of history and reconstruct society all over again. Right? That's the source of Burke's traditionalism. But unless we can think of these practices as in some sense self-determined, then they just be a form of traditionalism, which is incompatible, I just want to be funny here, incompatible with our necessary self-image of ourselves as free and self-determining subjects. That is, we cannot accept pure traditionalism, and we think that people who do are nuts. Why did you do that? Because God told me to. Oh, boy. Right? No, God can't tell you anything. Kant's right. You have to say, I take it. Right? So Kant says rightly, even if Jesus came down to earth and stood right in front of him and said, I'm Jesus Christ, and Kant would say, well, let's see if you're acting according to the moral law. I'm with Kant. I'm not going to accept anyone as a moral authority that doesn't go along with my reason. I cannot go through that level of self-denial. Conversely now, the Nietzsche side, Nietzsche's romanticism errs in the other direction. So that Zarathustra says, we're going to come back to this, that I soon become weary of my own legislations and feel that I need to legislate anew. And the reason that this happens, if I'm understanding Zarathustra correctly, is what he means by this is he feels that after he's already done a work of legislation, produced a work of art, produced a society, whatever, it's this problem, right? He feels that it no longer feels, once it's out there, self-determined. Once it's out there, it feels like an other determining to him, and he wants to reignite his feeling of being a self-determining legislator. Self-determination on its own, however, and that's all there is to Nietzsche's theory, it's just self-determination without end. That's what he means by eternal return, finally. But then and we know what lies behind this, that the only thing Nietzsche can think about is life or will to power. That I need the feeling of more life, more will to power. But the only meaning for that is self-determination. And therefore, nothing has any validity in terms of being. There is no for another in Nietzsche, and therefore no way in which a hyper process of self-making without end can ever do anything but go on and on and on without point or purpose. Which is why, just a bit of literary criticism, why the tone of Zarathustra becomes more and more hysterical. Right? It becomes adolescent and, really, I'm happy and joyful. I'm a dancing god. Whoa! Hey, Fred, calm down. Right? But there is an anxiety, and he does not know the source of the anxiety, and the anxiety is he has gotten rid of the other. He's gotten rid of his Burkean moment. The moment when he's actually in a circumstance and can't merely legislate anew, cannot extract himself. That moment is the moment of recognition, the moment of the we, then there really is just no we in Nietzsche, right? And therefore, Hegel is insisting, if you want, so the we and the I, I'm suggesting, are the moments of Nietzsche and Berg. The moment of the I is the Nietzschean moment of self-determination. The moment of we is the Bergian moment of having implication in this place, and it is a we that is an I, and an I that is a we, and that is spirit. We'll start there next week.